The latest from Washington on pandemic relief, Biden's VP pick, and more. With congressional negotiations for another relief package stalled, and with tens of millions of Americans losing enhanced unemployment benefits, President Trump issued three executive orders Saturday. They would extend some federal unemployment benefits, suspend student loans, and defer payroll tax collection. Right away, governors and others slammed the president's move as not nearly enough, and some questioned whether it was even legal. Meantime, Trump's Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, is expected to announce his vice presidential pick this week. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss these national stories and more with The Wall Street Journal's Gene Cummings and USM's Ron Schmidt. And we'll hear from Senator Angus King. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're going to talk about some of the news making national headlines, including the president's action on unemployment benefits, continuing concerns about how to best reopen the economy, and the expected announcement of Joe Biden of who will be his running mate. Our guests today are Gene Cummings, who is Deputy Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, and Ron Schmidt, a political science professor at the University of Southern Maine. His most recent book, Reading Politics with Machiavelli. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you want to know about stimulus aid? What are you watching for the November election? You can send us a brief email at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Gene and Ron, welcome back to Maine Calling. We love hearing your voice on this program. But first, for just a few minutes, joining us, Senator Angus King. Senator King, welcome back. Thanks for giving us a call. I understand many of your colleagues have come home. Are you home in Maine? Or are you in Washington?
I'm home. I drove back late Thursday night when it looked like the talks weren't going anywhere, but we're on a 24-hour return notice if we can get to an agreement, which I never thought I would say. I really want to leave Maine in August to go to Washington, but I hope I do for this particular purpose.
You issued a statement over the weekend saying you believe what the president did on Saturday was unconstitutional. It is not in his power to issue the executive orders he did. What do you say to the people of Maine who say, you know what, it may not be $600 in enhanced unemployment benefits, but it's something, and Congress wasn't giving us anything?
Well, I'm not sure it's really something. What he's proposing, let's be clear, is trying to move money from FEMA disaster aid to this unemployment support. It's not clear that he can do that even, but even if he can, then he says 100 of it has to be paid by the state, which is already in a $500 million hole because of the COVID. And just to put a round number on it, that extra $100 a week for the state would be $8 million a week. When we're already in pretty serious financial problems. He made a stab at it, but what he did doesn't cover business help. It doesn't help the schools. It doesn't help the states, testing, hospitals, stimulus checks. And the other piece is that, you know, he stepped in and said, oh, well, I'm going to do this by myself. And he really overstepped, I think, and we can the Congress can solve this. The problem is that Mitch McConnell has literally not been at the negotiating table. I know that's hard to believe, but he has basically outsourced the negotiations to the White House, and the White House turned down the Democrats on Friday. And I checked this to be sure I was right. Basically, came down $1 trillion in their proposal for how much aid there should be, and the White House said, nope, not going to do it, and that's what blew it up. But, the other piece, Jennifer, is we should have been having this discussion a month ago or 2 months ago. The House passed their bill on May 20th, which should have been the beginning of discussions. Mitch McConnell chose not to bring it up at all until about a week before everything expired. And, you know, everybody says, well, we should act quickly. Well, we should have been acting quickly around Memorial Day instead of waiting until, you know, the people lost their benefits. So I'm still hopeful that we can find some resolution, but it's you know, there's some real problems. The unemployment piece is a part of it, but help to the state is a critical part of it. And so far, as far as I know, there's not a single Republican proposal in the Senate that would provide any assistance whatsoever to localities, which are really hurting.
Senator King, I know home in Maine, you're running into small business owners, you're running into people who are collecting unemployment or were collecting unemployment who are saying to you, what can I expect? When will there be some relief? What are you saying to them?
Well, I'm saying that I know that the people that I'm working with want to get something done, and it could be done in 2 or 3 days. I was talking with one of my Republican counterparts over the weekend, and we said, you know, you and I ought to be able to do this. But they got the Republicans in the White House have to come back to the table. They're the ones that said, no, we're not going to do this. And as I say, it's sort of unbelievable that the majority leader, the Republican leader in the U.S. Senate, is not taking part in the negotiations at all. You know, you can't negotiate without one of the parties at the table. So I'll be talking to my colleagues again this afternoon. I've had an awful lot of conference calls in the last 3 days. I think there's been some movement, and I think there's room for compromise. I think there'd be a package that would work for everybody, but there's some things. I mean, for example, assistance to state and local governments is really important. They're just dying. Maine is a $500 million gap this year, this fiscal year, $850 in the next 2 years, and it's through no fault of their own. It's because of the coronavirus, and that doesn't even speak to the towns and cities in Maine that are hurting. So if the Republicans in the White House say no, not a dime for the states and localities, that's going to be very hard to get over. They want to say, well, let's just do the unemployment now. We'll talk about the rest later. The problem is there would be no later. So they're trying to do this as a comprehensive bill. And I haven't even mentioned the individual stimulus checks, which are important to keep the economy afloat. The thing I don't understand, Jennifer, is if we don't do anything, millions of people are going to be drastically hurt, and the economy itself is going to be drastically hurt. These unemployment benefits and stimulus checks have been keeping, you know, a lot of businesses alive, not to mention the PPP program. All that goes away, we're going to have a much worse recession because the pandemic is not over. And don't get me started on that. I mean, that we ought to be coming out of it now instead of going into the teeth of it in the Midwest.
I want to talk about the U.S. Census for just a moment. On Friday, just this past Friday, you and others wrote a letter to the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, urging a reversal on the decision to end the census 1 month early. Have you heard back?
We haven't heard back yet, and I find that a really puzzling decision. I mean, just arbitrarily say, okay, we're done. Come on, let's finish. This is really important. This defines, our apportionment among the states and voting, and has all kinds of ramifications. And to just say, you know, we're going to wind it up a month early, even though we're only, I think, less than halfway through the individual house-to-house census, doesn't make sense. So we haven't had any response to that whatsoever at this point. And it looks like they're trying to undercount, which, I just don't think that's the census is in the Constitution. It's something that's supposed to be done every year, every 10 years, rather. And it should be done as accurately as possible. And to just walk away from it before it's complete doesn't meet the requirements of the Constitution or the requirements of just fairness.
Finally, you've spoken to my colleague Erwin Gratz, as well as national news reporters, about the fate of the U.S. Postal Service. Are you hopeful that there can be some sort of fix in the short term so that the election goes smoothly?
Well, the first thing to say is that there was $10 billion in the original CARES Act that passed last March, earmarked for the post office, and the U.S. Treasury has refused to issue it. and they're bickering with the post office about supposed reforms, which, you know, this isn't the time for that. You asked me the question, am I confident it's going to be solved by the time of the election? I'm not, Jennifer, because the administration doesn't like the post office, and it looks like they may want to privatize it. They want to drive it under. The president has a beef with Amazon. He doesn't like Bezos, and so he says Amazon is ripping off the post office. The evidence I've seen is that that's not the case. But let's assume for a moment there are questions about what the package rate should be. We shouldn't be using that as a hammer to keep the post office from functioning solvently through the election and through the end of the year. It's sabotage, and I think it's I don't understand it, and that's one of the issues in the negotiation. We want to try to fix that, and so far the other side hasn't wanted to even talk about it.
All right. Well, Senator King, I know your time with us is short, but I can't let you go without asking you who you hope Joe Biden will pick to be his running mate.
Michelle Obama.
All right. We'll pass that on. Who of the names that of the people who've been vetted on the short list?
Well, I was just kidding about that, and I don't, I'm not involved in any way. Vice President Biden's going to choose the best person he thinks. I know several of the candidates, Kamala Harris and Tammy Duckworth, I know very well. I sit next to Kamala in the Intelligence Committee, and Tammy and I traveled to Iraq together last year. Both of them are outstanding people. I think both of them would be great vice presidents. And that's not to denigrate the other people. I just don't know them as well.
All right. Well, Senator Angus King, thank you so much for calling in to Maine Calling, as always. Turning to you, Ron Schmidt and Gene Cummings. Gene, you heard Senator King talking about Mitch McConnell. From your vantage point, sitting in Washington, D.C., what would you say to the people in Maine who are hoping that unemployment enhanced benefits are extended or that their small business might get some help? Will something happen this week?
Well, I think something probably will happen eventually because the pressure, it just continues to build on both the White House and Congress to do something. I found it interesting. The senator said he thought he has seen some movement. So that's good. But really what the president did over the weekend is so complicated that it's not going to really bring relief to people quickly, and it's unclear how long it will last. Even if the federal government were to use FEMA funds to pay people an extra $300, not $400, it's $300, because the states are supposed to pay the other $100, that money, many experts say, the money that FEMA has available would only last 5 weeks. So it's a short-term fix. If it works at all, it's likely going to be tied up in court. So that all of that means the pressure is just going to become enormous for them to reach a real negotiated deal.
Ron, what's the political calculus going on by Republicans for not coming up with a deal or negotiating a deal? And as Senator King, if he's saying this accurately, McConnell is giving the president the lead on this?
Frankly, I'm a little mystified. I second the senator's amazement that the Republican senators aren't really in the room for these negotiations. I question the decision of passing it off to the administration because the administration doesn't really seem to be acting with the best interests of incumbent Republicans in the Senate, much less the American people. The president's executive orders over the weekend are I think really non-starters. I mean, they're relying on other people spending money, on the states providing money that they don't have, on businesses undertaking reforms in the way that they withhold taxes for a short-term project, and on drawing money out of FEMA during hurricane season. And also there'll be court challenges. The president acknowledged as much when he signed the orders. If I were, say, Tom Tillis or, you know, another Republican defending his seat in difficult times, I'd be angry.
And Jen, I would just add, in McConnell's position is a very, very difficult one. One reason that he's letting the White House take the lead is because he can't unilaterally cut a deal unless he knows with certainty that Trump is going to sign it. So the White House has to be involved from McConnell's perspective. In addition, he's got a divided caucus. There are probably going to be a good number of Republicans who want to vote against this because some of them are getting really concerned about how much spending and borrowing is going on right now. So he's going to need the president to provide some cover so that he can get some of his caucus on board. So, you know, McConnell, he's in a very, very difficult spot. We also understand that he's under so much pressure from Senator Tillis, just like Ron was saying, I'm sure Sue Collins, too, to cut a deal. And then the other thing that we hear in our own reporting is that the real problem is Chief of Staff Meadows. This Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi have cut deals, but Meadows is the new player here. And what we're hearing is that Mnuchin's in the room trying to cut a deal, and Meadows is in the room trying to blow one up. So the White House has two negotiators, and they have two different objectives.
Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking with political science professor Ron Schmidt and The Wall Street Journal's Gene Cummings about national news. Have only so far talked about negotiations for a further stimulus package, but want to talk about Joe Biden and COVID and other national news when we come back. Stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Cancer Specialists, committed to excellence and now a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, newenglandcancerspecialists.org. TrueLine, a full-service marketing and branding agency who believes in the value of local independent journalism. Online at wearetrueline.com. And Island Housing Trust, building strong communities with year-round workforce housing on Mount Desert Island. Learn more at islandhousingtrust.org.
America's military remains the strongest in the world, but the rest of the government is slipping.
It's really becoming quite apparent that we increasingly rely on our military, in part because it's the only thing that we've kept relatively healthy and funded.
How preparing for tomorrow's wars may have left us ill-prepared for the pandemic. It's On the World.
The World is coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Our Pledge from Home summer supporter drive was a great success. Over 1,600 contributions were made for about $300,000. And significantly, we also welcomed in over 300 new supporters. Thanks for joining us, and thanks also to those of you who are ongoing supporters of this public service, public radio station for the great state of Maine. You make it possible. And we can all count on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical to provide us with months of essential news coverage and great classical music. Again, thanks to everyone who contributes to Maine Public. It makes a difference you can hear every day.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, national news. Our guest, The Wall Street Journal Deputy Bureau Chief Gene Cummings joins us from Washington, and Ron Schmidt, a professor of political science at USM. As always, we want to hear from you. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Gene, let's turn to the vice presidential stakes. Joe Biden originally said he would announce around August 1st. Now I understand it's this week. Politico is putting Kamala Harris as the most likely. I think a lot of people are putting out bets on who the vice presidential pick will be. What are your thoughts at this point?
Well, I do think we've narrowed it down. I mean, there could be a surprise where someone not on the short list could pop up. But that's unlikely, because by floating names around, that's kind of part of the vetting process. You know, if you look at some of the reporting around Susan Rice and her corporate background, that, you know, that's the kind of thing that the campaign wants to hear now, not after the appointment. So that's one reason that the names do get floated. I do think that Senator Harris, she had a very good relationship with the vice president. That first debate in which she was critical of him on school desegregation put a, you know, put a crimp in their relationship for a while, but they may well have gotten past it by now. So, you know, she could be the front runner. He's under a lot of pressure to choose a woman of color, given how important Black female voters were in the primary and basically rescued his campaign in South Carolina. So that puts a lot of pressure for a woman of color. And then you look at the Michigan governor, who we've reported traveled to Delaware. And, you know, she's in an important state. So does he want to pick based on geography, where he's trying to flip states, or does he want to pick based on building a coalition that looks like the Obama coalition? And those are kind of the ways to look at the choice he's making.
When do you think we'll hear?
I would bet Friday, late this week.
All right. You mentioned Susan Rice's corporate background. Susan Rice, of course, connections to Maine, a home in Maine, I believe maybe in Maine right now. Do you believe that the press that's been written about her recently has taken her out of the running?
I wouldn't say it's taken her out. I'm just saying that the reason the names get floated is so the campaign gets a look at how the media, investigative reporters, where are they going to go? And wherever they go is at a problem. And so there was a fair amount of attention to the corporate work. And, you know, the Democratic Party with, you know, Senator Warren leading the way has, you know, talked negatively about big business, big corporations for quite some time. The other thing I would think with Susan Rice, we understand that she has a very good relationship with the vice president, which that's important. But she also brings to the table foreign policy expertise, which Biden has a fair amount of right now on his own. So I'm not quite sure what exactly she brings to the table that puts her ahead of the others, but we'll see.
All right. And Ron, I want to ask you, how important is a vice presidential pick? We've seen the American University professor Alan Lichtman has gotten a lot of attention over the weekend for saying that in his calculations, not so much. What do you think?
That has been true up until now. Generally speaking, in at least sort of the modern era of presidential campaigns, a vice presidential choice can cause you a lot of damage, but it probably won't do you generally a lot of help. 2020, though, may be different for a number of reasons. One is that Joe Biden's age has become a factor in the campaign. He himself has talked about being a kind of generational bridge to the future for the Democratic Party, and that's drawing a lot of attention to his choice of a VP. Also, the personal relationships within his professional relationships are very important to Joe Biden. I think that's one of the reasons why Susan Rice is such a top candidate, because they have a strong working relationship. I think if Joe Biden were to choose a running mate with whom he can work easily, like he did with President Obama, that it could strengthen him as a candidate and as a president.
An email here from Mark. I was outraged this morning to read in today's Portland Press Herald how Susan Collins accused Democrats of not negotiating in good faith. I'd love to ask the senator this question. Why did Mitch McConnell sit on the House-passed $3.5 trillion bill for over 2 months until only 2 weeks remain for previously enacted benefits before offering up anything in response? Unconscionable. Gene?
Well, it is true they sat on that. And I think some Republicans were hoping they wouldn't have to do another one because they've already, we're in, the debt is, you know, astronomical now. And there was some hope with reopenings that maybe the economy would start coming back and it wouldn't be necessary to do one, or maybe not a really, really big one. Any hope of that obviously has not come true. The recovery is slow. It's spotty. It's start and stop. It's not a straight line. So more help is needed. So then he engages late, in part because of that.
All right, Ron, former Vice President Joe Biden and presidential candidate had some interviews this week, one on NPR, in which he had what people call his gaffes when he talked about African-American, the voting bloc, being similar as opposed to the Latinx voting bloc. How much do these gaffes hurt?
To some degree, it depends on how the rest of the campaign goes. The gaffes are more or less part of Biden's brand. So it's not like a gaffe is causing him any fresh damage. A big part is, as Gene said before, a big part, I think, of Joe Biden's campaign strategy is to build a broad Democratic Party coalition along the lines of the Obama administration's, only more so. A gaffe that seems to be directed at one of the most important sections of the Democratic Party is always potentially dangerous. But I think the question more is whether or not there's anything in these gaffes that can cause voters inclined to support him to rethink that support.
1-800-399-3566. Elaine on Facebook says, Gene Cummings thinks Biden will announce on Friday. Thought that was traditionally the day to report news that would fly under the radar, not something you'd want to get publicity for. Is Elaine right?
Well, she is definitely right that, you know, we all in journalism brace, you know, 5 o'clock on Friday, because that's when bad news often gets released. But it would allow him to dominate the weekend. If he did it later this week, then Sunday talk shows, you know, the weekend coverage leading up to the start of next week's Democratic convention would be all about the ticket. And so that's why, you know, it's a guess, though. She is absolutely right. I could be wrong, and we could find out something really terrible on Friday at 5 o'clock.
Ron, the primaries are not going to look like traditional primaries this year. How much does that matter?
I mean, to a large degree, hopefully what we're doing now is learning what voting looks like under these extraordinary conditions, learning what some of the major vulnerabilities we have are, and learning to expect a wait before we get answers in regard to who wins elections. If we can learn from our mistakes and get a new sense of our environment before November 3rd, all of this could be to our advantage. One of the big things that I think, as a political scientist, I feel like I have a responsibility to reinforce to the public is that if we have to wait a while to find out the winners of the election, that doesn't necessarily mean the system is broken. And hopefully this particular primary election season is helping us do that.
All right. Gene, I'm wondering what you're noticing now. You have such a finely tuned sense of electoral politics. What kind of movement is happening that's perhaps going to grow into a much bigger story?
Well, some of the what we are going to watch very carefully are the suburbs, because that was the big shift 2 years ago. Is when the suburban voters shifted and voted Democratic. We'll see if that holds for the presidential. If it does, then Michigan, Pennsylvania, you know, they're going to be a lot harder for President Trump to hold on to if the sentiment in the suburbs is similar to what happened in 2018.
I'm going to go to Mike, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to add about the VP pick significance. This may be the most Joe Biden will enter office if he does get elected this fall at 78. Ronald Reagan left office at 77. Essentially, Joe Biden is maybe picking the next president of the United States when he chooses a VP. So this is the most significant pick for vice president since FDR picked Harry Truman when the Democratic Party was concerned about FDR's health.
Mike, do you have an opinion who you'd like to see Biden pick?
I think we need somebody to go, a VP to go clean up our relationships with the rest of the world. And I would suggest Susan Rice for that. I think Kamala Harris would probably be able to go into the Attorney General's office and get that department reestablished and build some confidence up within that department.
Mike, thanks for your call. And Ron, what do you think about that? I mean, it's a fact that Joe Biden would be the oldest president, and people don't want to think about it that way, but the vice president could become the president.
It's true. And I think I've actually seen a lot of talking about that. I think that has gone into the decision-making over with at the former vice president's campaign headquarters. Also, assuming that he makes it all the way through a first term and chooses not to run for re-election, the person who serves as vice president is a very likely leading Democratic candidate for 24. And assuming that he does want to serve a second term, that person is still going to be positioned to be a very important figure in the future of the Democratic Party. So this choice is, even if the worst doesn't happen there, this person is going to be an important player for the Democrats and for the United States.
Gene, I read reporting several weeks ago about the Biden staff talking about whether or not to let it be public that Biden only wanted to serve one term. Was that, I'm sure that you reported and heard the same thing. Has that gone away?
Well, no, not entirely. But they can't make that kind of commitment publicly because he's an instant lame duck if they were to do that. So what I think is, you know, like Ron pointed out, he uses his language of being the bridge candidate. I think that's indicative that he's probably going to serve one term and then hand the reins over to the next generation. But they don't want to explicitly say this because then it could change the way voters look at him. Because they might evaluate the Veep instead of him. So he can't, it's just, there's no advantage to them saying it publicly.
I'm going to go to Mary calling from Winslow. Hi, Mary, go ahead.
Hey, Jen, thank you. Would you please ask your callers from their two different perspectives why the news keeps reporting what is going to happen, like who Biden might choose for vice president, instead of the stuff that has already happened, like Ms. Cummings' very interesting explanation of Mitch McConnell's dilemma, which I had not thought about.
What would you like them to analyze that has happened this past week we haven't talked about yet?
Why so much of the news is prediction rather than reporting?
Jean?
Well, we like to do both, I guess. you know, we're in a competitive business, and, you know, we want to try to be first with the news, and so we try to stay on top of it, on top of it, on top of it. And I know it gets repetitive, and I apologize for that. But we are trying to do both analysis or news reporting and as much reporting as we can to allow people to know what might be around the corner.
Mary, thanks for your question. We have a question coming in about the Postal Service. I'm going to ask that when we come back. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about news out of Washington. We have Gene Cummings from The Wall Street Journal and Ron Schmidt at USM. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post on our Facebook page, or tweet at Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Marshall Communications. With its new ebook, 10 Tips for How Your Small Business Can Beat COVID-19 with Empathy and Action, marshallpr.com. Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco. And the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On August 10th, 1622, John Mason and Sir Ferdinando Gorges received the land patent of the province of Maine. Born in 1566, Gorges was a naval and military commander and governor of the important port of Plymouth in England. He was involved in Essex's rebellion against the Queen, but escaped punishment by testifying against the Maine conspirators. His early involvement in English trade with and settlement of North America earned him the title of the Father of English Colonization in North America, even though Gorges himself never set foot in the New World.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine. On the next Speaking in Maine, addressing national threats and emergencies.
In a number of states in the past couple of months, you know, American citizens have let their guard down.
Join us for a discussion on how well the U.S. government prioritizes and responds to national emergencies. This program is one of many from the recent 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute, whose theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks and Maine Calling. We're talking about news out of Washington. My guests, Gene Cummings with the Wall Street Journal and Ron Schmidt at USM. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Gene, the Wall Street Journal and others reported that the U.S. hit 5 million confirmed cases of COVID over this weekend. It seems sometimes that there's not a sense of alarm in Washington. Why not?
Well, I think that are you talking about the White House in particular? I think the president he's tried to strike a balance. I don't know if he has succeeded between an economic recovery and managing the virus. He totters between the two of them. He has halfway embraced masks, which I think has confused the country. When he had his interview with Jonathan Swan of Axios, Jonathan Swan, you know, pointed out that many of the people that we have seen at the president's rallies are not wearing masks or at his events. And those are his people, and those are the ones who are at risk. I wondered if that was an approach that would make the president think a little more about how well and how strenuously he's promoting the mask. It's also the path forward for the economy. And that's the way we get out of everything. But the mixed messages have really hurt our nation in terms of, getting past this. In some ways, the business community is almost imposing a national mask rule because so many big companies, Walmart, CVS, you know, Starbucks, big companies across the country are now requiring masks. So in a way, by default, you know, that's going to increase the number of people wearing them. But, you know, I mean, it seems the obvious path to the future, but we just, as a nation, are just not doing a good job at it.
Ron, I want to, presidents can really set the tone for their administrations through the things that they choose to emphasize and the way that they do it. And the president has said that regarding our scale of COVID-19 infection and deaths, that it is what it is. That message, I think, spreads across the administration and to some degree across his party, which also then affects the tone that we're hearing from Congress.
Ron, I wanted to ask you, looking at this as a political scientist and a campaign, looking at campaign analysis, James Carville, I believe, is famous for saying it's the economy, stupid. When we're in the midst of a global pandemic, is it still the economy that voters are going to vote on come November?
Well, I mean, the economy, of course, is very important. And in this election, it's not just anxiety. It's you know, direct fear about the level of economic disruption. But underlying all that, exactly as Jean said, is the pandemic. And our only way to move forward out of this economic mess is to deal with COVID-19.
An email here from Jim. Would you address what's going on with President Trump's major donor as Postmaster General? A two-day package sent from Maine hasn't arrived 7 days later. It could be, of course, a fluke, but these stories are happening all over. In Portland, just over a week ago, the postmaster allegedly ordered first-class mail to be delayed a full day so fourth-class boxes could be delivered first. Does Congress or any other entity have any say? Jean?
Congress is becoming alarmed about that, and I wouldn't be surprised if we don't soon see some hearings regarding that, because the health and management of the post office could be vital to the election in November if we end up going to mail-in ballots in a broad way. I kind of wish everyone would put on their masks so that everyone could vote in person in November without so much fear. But until that happens, you know, it could be that the post office is the lifeline for the election. And so I think Congress is going to engage.
An email here from Nancy, so also concerned about the post office. She writes, I am concerned about Trump stealing the election by usurping the U.S. Postal Service. We will need to vote in person if we can't trust the head of the Postal Service, who may be destroying the Postal Service prior to the election. Ron, are you concerned about the legitimacy and the legitimacy of the votes?
The legitimacy is a key word. It's like, you know, those Roadrunner cartoons where the coyote can run off a cliff as long as he doesn't notice that he's off the cliff, but as soon as he looks down, he falls. The viability of our democratic system depends to a large degree on voters assuming that the system is legitimate and assuming that they can trust the outcomes of elections. A crisis at the post office is, in addition to the president tweeting about the election being rigged, are important steps at eroding that sense of legitimacy. That's a real worry.
Jean, is this something when the Wall Street Journal looks out and does surveys and talks to your readers and talks to the American public, is this something that is on their radar at this point?
Well, the concerns about safety in voting in person is on their minds for sure. And I don't believe that the status and of the postal office has penetrated in a real deep sense across the country. But I think concerns about how the voting process is going to unfold is definitely on people's minds, because you know the states went through a primary process, or most states did, where you know they had to make choices. And, you know, some went to mail, others went in person. That happened in Wisconsin, really long lines, and some people did get sick. Now, that was way before we started talking about put your mask on. And so hopefully that could be prevented in November if everyone, you know, does take the safety precautions.
An email here from Lenny. In my mind, putting Biden's gaffes on the same level as Trump's lies and cruel political behavior, such as clearing Lafayette Square, sending unidentified federal thugs to protest, distorting the facts on the ground, distorting what's happening with COVID, and much more, is an egregious false equivalency. The press could hand the presidency to Trump again, and that would be disastrous for the country. What do your guests say? Gene, I know this is probably a criticism that you're used to, this idea that by reporting something, you're offering up a false equivalency.
Right. It's something that we talk a lot about in the office. I don't believe that they are equivalent. And I don't think the news side of the Wall Street Journal has written stories in a way that make it sound so. When it comes to Biden's gaffes, I think Ron hit the nail on the head. It's part of his brand. You know, I've been covering Joe Biden since 1992. I mean, this is just, if you're going to be around the guy for a long period of time, he's likely to say something awkwardly. And the one thing that is a little different in this cycle is that he has been very quick to try to step back and say, wait a minute, you know, I phrased that poorly or whatever, and then I'm sorry if I offended so-and-so. So they are staying on top of it as best they can. But, you know, gaffes and Biden, they kind of go hand in hand.
An email here from Linda. I think rather than looking at a potential one-term presidency for Joe Biden as a negative lame duck, it should be considered as a positive to have a president who will make decisions based upon what is best for the country rather than what could get him reelected. Ron, any historical precedent there?
I mean, there is thinking that even if a president is completely is much more interested in his own fortunes than in the fortunes of the country, there is a thinking that that is a reason for them to try to be a particularly good president because that will increase their chances of being reelected. So those things aren't necessarily opposed. Still, presidents have to deal with other powerful people in Washington and globally, and for good reasons or for bad, lame ducks are generally seen as having less political capital to play with.
Gene, there's been some reporting lately about how Republican members of the Senate and the House of Representatives are having to be very careful in how they talk about President Trump, in even changing some of their messaging in the last couple weeks. What do you expect to see going forward from these Republicans? And I include in them the Republican senator here in our state, Senator Collins. Talk about the position they are in and as they face the November election.
Yes, they are in tough places. There's just no doubt about it. The president's poll numbers aren't good. He's not popular. He's not viewed favorably, except until recently in terms of handling the economy. And his numbers aren't underwater on that front, but they've dipped down. And so if the voters are mad at Trump, but your name is Senator Collins, Susan Collins, you need them to look at you separately and try to keep him out of their way of thinking about how they want to vote. That's a really hard thing to do. And there are about eight of them, eight Republicans, who are now trying to, you know, strike that balance. And it's tough because President Trump's going to be running tons of ads in Maine for his own race. And so it's not like he's not going to be ever present. He will be.
I'm so glad you mentioned ads, Ron. There are so many ads already. Holy cow. And they're not just on television. My kids go on TikTok and there's ads. You go on Facebook and there are ads. You go into any of the newspapers and there are ads. At some point, is it just noise?
It can be just noise, just some sort of white noise in the background. It can be aggravating, or even in some cases potentially drive down public interest in an election. With my kid, it's YouTube, and the ads are constant and relentless to the point. I mean, she's 8 years old, and she already is making fun of the content of these ads. Again, 2020 may turn out to be different from most years. The public seems to be very engaged with politics right now. Some of the highest ratings on primetime television now are for news shows, which is weird. It may be that there's an appetite for that, and there's certainly a budget for it. The campaigns have a lot of money, and they're spending it as fast as they can. It's August. I would expect to see some level of fatigue with all of this by the time Election Day rolls around. What I won't try to predict in this year of all years is what consequences that fatigue might have.
All right. And we've talked about the post office a little bit, Gene, but we haven't talked about the impact of early voting. I have friends who have already requested their ballots and in other states. And I'm wondering if we expect to see between the pandemic and just the idea that people want to vote early for personal reasons, how will that affect the election?
Well, it could in a way help because some states can get those early votes counted in advance. So they're locked in the computer on election day. It also would then tamp down on the number of people who have to expose themselves on election day as well. So it could be helpful. Unlike the primary, when there was a lot of early voting in California, for instance, and then by the time election day came around, people had voted for a candidate who would quit. And so this one won't be like that. We'll have these two guys through November.
Yeah, and Ron, how could that affect the down ballot races, though? I think polls show that most Americans know who they're going to vote for president. But what about the other races? How might that affect our U.S. Senate race here in Maine?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. At this point, the Biden campaign is ahead. It might sort of behoove them if Maine voters vote early. But what that could mean for say, Sarah Gideon challenging Susan Collins, I'm not sure. What Gene said before about the awkward position that Collins is in right now is definitely true. And the president could make things more complicated for her still. You know, I tell my students about the former speaker, Tip O'Neill, who said all politics are local, implying that if you're running in Maine, you're going to have a different profile somewhat from party leaders in other parts of the country. President Trump's very impatient with that. He doesn't like to see Republicans put a lot of space between themselves and him. And that could lead to some awkwardness between now and November.
All right. An email here from Linda. Please mention that people can turn absentee ballots into their town office and avoid the mail. Thank you, Linda, for that. And thank you for our guest today. And sorry to all of you who we couldn't get to questions. A lot to talk about. Gene Cummings, Deputy Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, and Ron Schmidt, a political science professor at the University of Southern Maine. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and today's Maine Calling will be rebroadcast at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.